Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes, copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes, and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. As we ended the last episode, the author was considering the condition of her suburban soil. We resume Suburban Safari on page 89 with episode 9. Suburban soil, despite the insults we heap on it, may be in better shape than the soil at the neighborhood farm. Or it may not be. If I were to draw a line from the heart of downtown, out through my suburban yard, across a farm field, and into the forest, I would probably find that some soil features improved with distance from the city. Scientists who conduct these transect studies find that the concentration of poisonous metals tends to diminish as you move away from the city, the number of helpful fungi climbs, and the number of troublesome foreign invaders decreases. But for all its flaws, suburban soil does some tasks expertly. In some regards, converting farmland to lawn is an ecological improvement. To get acquainted with my soil, I set about digging holes. I also tie red ribbons around a few items to see how long it takes them to return to the earth. I mark a fresh oak leaf thrown to the ground by squirrels, a young acorn, and an apple from one of the trees. One of my experiments is terminated by a squirrel within a couple of hours, leaving the apple and the leaf. My first few holes are really above ground. Glamorous soil makers like the slug do their composting on the surface of the earth rather than within it, so I plop myself on the chaise lounge, killing oh so many citizens, and stare into the gloom beneath the oak tree. There is my ribboned oak leaf, brown before its time. Its surface is still shiny and smooth. It lies on a bed of last year's leaves. I pick up a stick and flip up a layer of the leaf litter. It's a thin layer indeed, just one dead leaf thick. Fine litter below is composed of gnawed baby acorns, plus shreds of grapevine and oak bark. But that layer, too, is less than an inch deep when I poke at it. That's curious. In a forest, the leaf litter would be 4 or 5 inches deep. It would protect insects and soil makers from weather and predators. Where did all my leaf litter go? Earthworms ate it. That's what I discover. Maine is supposed to be an earthworm-free zone. In fact, all the northeastern states and Canada would be earthworm-free in a people-free world. When successive glaciers scoured northern realms down to bedrock, they shoved both soil and soil makers south or froze them into oblivion. While much of the country has native earthworms, every one in my yard is from immigrant stock, just as I am. His and her forefathers and mothers, earthworms are hermaphroditic, journeyed to North America in ships. Some may have arrived in the muck of a horse's hoof. Others may have been shoveled into a ship's hold with European rocks and soil that were used as ballast. Still others may have arrived with shipments of olive or apple trees or the tea rose that one of my ancestors dug out of her old-world garden. It's hard to imagine who could complain about an invasion of foreign earthworms. They're worshipped by gardeners because they aerate soil and convert dead plants into organic fertilizer. But there are people with a bone to pick with worms, and the primary complaint, thus far, is that the invaders convert the dead plants to fertilizer at an alarming rate. This causes a change in soil chemistry. While that change is welcome in the lawn and garden, it's dangerous for forests. And worms are spreading into the woods. Margaret Carrero, a biologist at the University of Louisville, compares northeastern earthworms to foreign zebra mussels that are causing billions of dollars in damage to water pipes each year as they spread through lakes and rivers in the eastern United States. "Everyone worries about zebra mussels," she has protested to American Forests magazine. "What about earthworms?" Here under my oak tree, the earthworms have been diligent. Beneath the thin leaf litter, the fine litter blends into dark soil. But, as researchers have noticed, in real forests, the litter in my mini forest appears to be devoid of fungi. In a forest primeval, nets and mats of fungi would do much of the decomposing. They'd take years to digest the flesh of a leaf. At just the right speed, they'd convert the leaf to a form of fertilizer ideal for trees. This circle, tree feeds fungi feeds tree, was forged through evolutionary trial and error. It isn't responding well to the worms, who produce the wrong kind of nitrogen. To my eye, the oak tree looks fine, but what do I know? I thought earthworms belonged here. As I tinker with the litter, something moves. I realize I'm staring at a jerking hair. It's 2 inches long. One end is white and kinky. The other is amber and straight. A squirrel hair? An ant is tugging on it. That ant gives up and paces around in the litter. A sister ant takes a turn tugging. They tag team for 20 minutes, causing something in the fine litter to heave, but making no real progress. Impatient, I grip the hair with my tweezers. Yuck, yuck, yuck! The hair is stuck to a gluey worm whose chewed body is clotted with more bits of litter. Yuck! I return it to the ants and move on to the next heaving pile. I'm relieved to find that this one hides a healthy sow bug. Like earthworms, these creatures convert dead plants to soil. One paper I read says that this family of creatures may produce about 140 pounds of micro-manure per acre each year in a French oak forest. That would translate into 28 pounds of fertilizer spread over the space of my yard if I have a similar population. Like the earthworms in my area, almost every species of isopod, also known as sow bugs, pill bugs, roly-polies, wood lice, around here is imported. In addition to being foreign, they're strange. They're crustaceans, like lobsters. They breathe through gills, which limits their travels to places that are damp. They stick to urban and suburban realms and don't stray much into the wilds. Most bizarre, though, the mommies carry their eggs and then their fresh-hatched babies in a pouch. I visit with an expert on soil creatures at Johns Hopkins University who tells me how it works. The mother produces fluids to keep the eggs moist, explains Katalin Slavich, spelled S-Z-L-A-V-E-C-Z, an angular Hungarian woman. For a scientist, it's very convenient. You can see how many eggs each one has, and it's really cute. They have little flaps that open and... She swishes a hand. Out they go. Katalin Slavich guides me through her lab. The shelves are crowded with bottles of preserved squirmies, worms, bugs, grubs. Lots of dead animals, she sighs. But her workbench is loaded with terraria, and they hold living animals. A glass box of isopods has a tiny portrait of Mona Lisa taped to it. The next looks empty, but Katalin reaches in and scoops out an inch-long millipede. He's the color of varnished mahogany. This one is just a pet animal, she says, smiling at him. Oh, I'm sorry. He slips from her hand and hits the floor with a click. See, she tells me, setting him back in his tank. I do care about them. I'll give them some food, too. From a bag of old leaves and twigs under the bench, she selects a handful of aged squirmy chow. Oak leaves have to be overwintered before an isopod will touch them, she explains. Leaves have a lot of cellulose and lignin that are hard to digest. Bacteria and fungi soften it up, especially for smaller animals that don't have strong mouth parts. They remove the tannins and break the molecules into small pieces. On another shelf, She keeps a collection of leaves in various stages of decomposition. One has been scraped only on its tender bottom surface, leaving a leaf of half thickness. Another has been cleansed of all flesh, leaving all the fine veins. Maybe a small worm or a springtail, Catalin guesses. The final leaf retains only its major veins, an isopod or a millipede. Next, she takes me home to her backyard and tears apart a woodpile. "We have to get rid of this pile," she says sadly. "Termites. We'll keep a little of it." She is melancholy because the woodpile is crawling with pets, easily overlooked animals making dirt. Barehanded, she pulls the bark off a log, revealing a layer of coffee grounds. Poop. Animal poop. An orange millipede wriggles for cover, and a sow bug squeezes into a crack. Catalin goes after it with a gentle fingernail. "I think I hear her say, 'Hey, hun,' to an isopod." Among the logs, spiders guard egg sacs. Millipedes and centipedes writhe in profusion. "These guys grind up big chunks of leaf or wood," Catalin says. "By producing feces, they increase the bacteria, because the feces have more surface area to work on. So then the droppings themselves are decomposed." She sits back and looks at the logs, which are turning to soil before our eyes. "There's so much variety. There are so many ways of making a living. I don't think people are aware of it. That's why they call soil dirt." "I never call soil dirt. It has a negative tone to it," she smiles self-consciously. "Then, if people do know about these animals, they find them downright ugly." Back in my own yard on my chase, my gaze drifts through the grass to where a dandelion bud bobs. Looking closer, I discover a golden slug wrapped around the green and yellow knob. He's noshing. His tongue is too small for me to see, but I've read that it's prickly as a file, and it scrapes plant flesh into his throat. Moisture in the food is converted to moisture on his hide. I scoop him into a ceramic ramekin. It's a high-rent petri dish, but I can't find a place that sells real ones in lots of less than 100. I stick the slug under the microscope. He's gorgeous. He glistens in the sun. Food comes to mind. Butterscotch syrup. Figs. A breathing hole in his flank blows a bubble. Checking on him with the naked eye, I'm horrified to find him looking sandy and dry. A yellow scum is forming around him in the ramekin. Egad, I've killed 100 slugs in my life, but now that I've met this beautiful fellow, I feel terrible about his plight. I hustle him into the shade and let him go. Perhaps addled by sunstroke, he plows under a hoop of rootlet and gets stuck. Slugs can't move backward. I feel guilty, but not guilty enough to rescue a possibly deranged slug with my bare hands. And when I investigate his natural history, I find that he's yet another urban specialist imported to this continent by people. Some slugs are native to North America, but not this common gold one. Is no earth-eater in my yard a native? Earwigs? Nope, not the common kinds. At least they prey on destructive insects in addition to plants. Surely some fungi must be aboriginal. My next hole is even higher off the ground. The recycling of organic matter often begins before a plant even succumbs. My crows, in their doodling, snap twigs from the apple trees and drop them to the lawn. The squirrels nibble off the bark. Sapsuckers and beetles also bore into trees, showering shavings into the grass. Fungi, which I've been told web across the surface of every living and dead thing, erode dead bark, wood, and leaves, softening the fibers. Lichens convert the bark of my aged apple trees to crinkly lace. Then they shed fragments of themselves. On a nearby stump I find a virtual island on which soil making is the main industry. A wood fungus, ruffled like a Victorian collar, is sucking nutrition from the stump. dull at first glance, under the microscope, a piece of the mushroom is marvelous. Bands of gray, cream, and brown are made of parallel fibers, and each color has a different texture. The gray rings are made of upturning fibers for a fake fur effect. The silver ones lie flat. The brown fibers look rotten, but they're not. I wash my hands carefully when I'm done playing with it. Later, I read that this mushroom, Coriolis versicolor, or turkey tail, has a long history as a medicinal plant whose anti-tumor reputation is being endorsed by modern science. I'm pleased to have it around. A second fungus lurks inside the same stump, this one shaped like black fingers. When I touch it, a finger snaps off. Under the microscope, it's scary, not lovely. Black as lava and glittery, it seems constructed from a foam of black balloons. These must be spore hatcheries. Some of the bubbles are open, their spores having flown the coop. Through the matrix crawl mites the color of raw oysters, nearly too small to see. I find one more fungus, more alarming than the last. It's a foam that starts on the stump, then oozes over the grass. It's the color of toasted marshmallow on the outside, gooey white inside. Under the microscope, the crust looks like toasted coconut. All these fungi, aided by weather and a cast of thousands, have digested enough of the stump that its nutrients are available for new plants. This I know because a spray of black raspberry canes soars from the stump's center. A bird must have deposited seeds here, and the seeds found sufficient soil to construct a new plant. Behind ramparts of dead wood, the sprouts are safe from the lawnmower. I imagine that in 10 years the remainder of the stump will be colonized, leaving only a green hump in the landscape. I wander on, into the raspberry tangle, an epicenter of plant malice. Black raspberry canes, 12 feet long, anchor themselves in the soil at both ends, forming thorny leghold traps for people. Hidden beneath them are carcasses of strangled trees. Green cords of Asiatic bittersweet bind all together. I've dallied in any number of tropical jungles, and I've never lost as much blood as I've shed here. I enter clad in canvas and leather. While I'm in here, I'll prune out enough of the chaos to make berry picking a non-fatal activity. Starting at the edges, I reach through the thorns to snip out cane after cane. As the thicket thins, soil appears under my feet. Signs of life turn up, too. Human life. When things fell in here, people dared not retrieve them. The metal ring of a frisbee-style toy has taken on the exact color of dirt. Only its perfect circularity betrays it. When I try to toss it on the lawn, it sails into the bamboo wilderness, where it will probably spend another few decades. I find 2 golf balls with the rising soil reaching to their midlines. Here's a strip of aluminum from a car windshield. The inevitable beer bottles and cans were probably tossed by teenagers tippling in the privacy of the bamboo. How long, I wonder, before the silica and aluminum rejoin the soil from whence they came? Glass, I imagine, is similar to obsidian and probably erodes at a comparable rate. Aluminum is more vulnerable to oxygen. Old beer cans seem to get flimsy after just a few years in the weeds. Accompanying the human contributions to tomorrow's soil are some squirrely donations. A jab of my shovel turns up a ghostly spike emerging from a black knob. Oops! My oak tree has for years been trying to produce an heir, and just when a forgetful squirrel gives it a break, here comes the spade. I poke the punky knob back into the dirt, with low hopes. I presume squirrels are also responsible for the clusters of Norway maple sprouts striving for light under the vines. It looks as though the seeds were buried by the dozen. I know these sprouts would love to take the long route to soil, first sucking up every molecule of moisture and nourishment from my yard, starving out my berries, then thriving for a century or two before decaying, but hark! I hear the squeak of hungry fungi. I bash the seedlings with the shovel and feed the mushrooms. Every day I check on my beribboned articles. It's not heart-stopping drama. Over a few weeks the leaf assumes a boat shape. It softens and darkens at the bottom, where it contacts the litter. An area the diameter of a pea is skeletonized. The apple also goes slowly. Even before it dropped from the branch, insects had punched holes in it, perhaps to deposit eggs. Once it fell, these punctures invited other diners. One day I find ants converting a hole to a cave. Another day, when I lift the apple, a beetle scuttles down into the earth. Gradually, the holes widen. Brown spots expand. Each puncture lets out some water, which comprises most of an apple. The apple shrinks. Tunnels now connect the apple to the depths. Miners commute up and down, stirring apple into soil. I, too, am ready to tunnel down and see what I can see. I need to dig holes anyway to plant the posts that will corral my tamed berries. The first few bites of the shovel lift a chocolate layer of earth. The white roots of lawn plants weave a mesh through it. After a moment of stillness, the cliffs of my shallow hole break into motion. Ants emerge to swirl across the opened earth like birds. My next slice gets under the chocolate and into a crumbly cocoa of dirty sand. Rocks the size of arrowheads jut from the wall. At 9 inches, I spot brown glass. I shovel this layer into a screening box and shake it. When the soil is gone, Euro junk remains jumping on the wire. A charred bean, half the size of beans I know. Clamshell fragments. A bit of glazed pottery. Back into the hole, I've opened a layer that's home to a species of ant almost too small to see. They're beige specks that glide over the cliff. At 15 inches, only the occasional root protrudes from the wall. Here the cocoa meets an orange layer of sand. The rocks are bigger. Old tunnels of moles and worms are recorded as tubes of dark soil that dive into the orange layer. This reminds me of the soil tilling that my cheeky chipmunk is undertaking. His tunnel system is many yards long, linking any number of escape holes. And as he burrows, he aerates and mixes the soil. And on his silken pelt he carries helpful fungi from one part of the lawn to another. Cheeky's homemaking maintains healthy soil. At 18 inches, the rocks consort too thickly to shovel. When I lift them out, they fall apart in my hands, like loaves of sliced bread. Frost has split them where they lay. The only root I encounter is that of Asiatic bittersweet, a tree-strangling invasive vine which I savage on principle. At 24 inches, I encounter the maroon cone of a nightcrawler's head. Not wanting to injure him, I tap his noggin. He's either too torpid or too stubborn to back down. I cover him carefully before setting my post. As I screen the dirt from the lower layers, I see why the people who once farmed my yard grew apples. It's all rocks. Plowing this stuff would have been like raking billiard balls. But the fact that 6 inches of soil lie atop the Euro junk gives me pause. It seems kind of deep, considering that soil generally develops at a snail's pace. The global average rate of soil formation is about an inch every 450 years. Perhaps someone leveled the land when the houses were built, covering the garbage. Or maybe an old compost pile sat here, or a leaf pile. The possibilities are beyond number, says Dr. Samantha Langley Turnbaugh, an environmental scientist at the University of Southern Maine. The traditional soil forming factors fly out the window, she explains, when she visits my yard. Especially in the dense urban areas, you find fill, fill, fill. It's totally unpredictable, and you smell things that make you think, I wonder what that is. The most obvious difference between town soils and farm or forest soils is that people tend to compact the soils they live on. Good soil is like good cake. It should be about half crumbs, held together by fungi, worms, slime, and other glues. The other half should be pore spaces through which air and water flow. But when I walk across my yard, I squash air out of the cake. The soil has some resilience, but after enough stomping, the crumbs are not going to bounce back into place. The pore spaces close permanently. Roots need water and oxygen, just like people do, Samantha says. Without them, they die. She has been sending students to take core samples of the soil of Deering Oaks Park in Portland. The venerable oaks are ailing after more than a century of farmers' markets, fairs, concerts, and strolling. As for the soil, Samantha grimaces, a half-meter core is ideal. We can't get the probe in any deeper than half an inch. We've broken so many of these probes. Driving and walking over damp soil is the best way to convert it from cake to fudge. It's not uncommon for much trodden soils to exhibit a density identical to that of a brick. Even driving past them can do damage. The vibration from traffic can break down soil too deep to be squashed by feet and the occasional lawn tractor. It's one more thing to feel bad about when I drive. I'm not just heating the planet and commissioning the sloppy harvest of gloppy oil. I'm also wrecking the crumb structure of soil. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of the Maine Reader. We're reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is the Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.